Let me bring you Sandra White.
Are you glad? Come on, people. I can't hear you. I said, are you glad? Raise it up, y'all. Come on. Let me hear you. I'm going to tell you why I'm glad. 8 dark years of Giuliani are gone! Give it a hand! Thanks to Mike Bloomberg, we're back on the steps of City Hall. And I used to sweep those streets for a welfare check. I had to urinate on the sidewalk between cars and a truck one day because businesses denied me use of their restrooms while sweeping. I had to storm Commissioner Parks Henry Stern's office with my associates for clothing just to keep warm. We fought them and we got the clothing, all right? We got the clothing, okay? I wore this green hat, we got the clothing. Okay, all you gotta do is go get it, okay? You don't ask, you just go get it, all right? And I'm not on welfare anymore, but there are people that still are. And I'm an organizer, and I'm still mad, and I'm still not gonna take it anymore, okay? Because that's where I'm coming from, and we're all in this together. I'm doing my best to make sure that all welfare recipients get treated with dignity and respect like all should be. That they get training and education to live a better life for themselves and their children and their children's future. If welfare recipients have to do well, I don't want to hear anything more about recipients dying or being sexually harassed or being denied bathroom privileges and having to pick up dead dogs while being treated like one at the same time. And there's been a war on the poor since the beginning of time. In the book of Zechariah, the Lord tells those in authority to take care of the poor, the widows, and the fatherless. The Giulianis of this world have not done that. It's by God's grace that we're here to be a voice for the people, all of us here, and the Giulianis of this world will not prevail. Can I get a hand clap on that one? You got that right. You got that right. Now listen here. December 31st of 2001, with the help of one man's signature, Bill Clinton, turned this country into a nation of poverty worse than the days of the Depression. December 31st caused 40,000 people just in New York State to be cut off welfare. More than 60% of poor children get no welfare help, and the number of ineligible families is going to rise as more people use up their lifetime eligibility with each passing year. In all but a handful of states, the lifetime limit is 5 years or even less. Still, eligibility doesn't mean much. The red tape, for example. And you all know what I'm talking about. Those of you that have been involved in welfare, you got those multiple appointments, complicated forms, long working, hard working, rude people. I think you have to fill out an application when you go apply for that job and say you're rude because that's just how you're going to act, okay, so you fit the bill. And stupid rules that discourage even the most desperate from seeking help. In many states, the official policy is diversion, okay? If the applicant looks like she's fit to work, then let her go seek help and let her go get a job on her own. Now, benefit levels have gone up a little in some states, but are below the poverty line everywhere and below half the poverty line in many states. The price of assistance in some places, such as New York City, is to go to a workfare program that teaches no skills, provides no help in finding a job, pays no wages, and therefore allows no access to the earned income tax credit. Now, often it denies necessary safety equipment and apply sanctions for the slightest infraction, real or alleged. Sufficient assistance should be guaranteed as the economy sours and joblessness continues to rise. A new vision for welfare will require many changes in perspective. Policymakers and political elites will have to acknowledge that TANF needs to accommodate the realities facing low-income families today. States and welfare administrators will have to change the orientation of the system from beat them down and get them off to lift them up. We have to lift up people and not shut them down, and that's what they have to learn. Federal and state resources must be sufficient to meet them all. That means everybody who applies. Now, there are still kinks in what is being done that need to be ironed out in terms of getting recipients onto the safety net after their time limit runs out. I'm running down to you what is happening now with welfare. This is current. Some recipients aren't being informed, but one thing's for sure, and listen up, guys, whenever they find employment, regardless of their check size, 10% of their paycheck each payday will be taken out and go back to the government for every penny they ever got from the system. The Parks Workfare recipients just got the attention they needed, they're looking for, just a little bit brighter. They still need benefits. The organization I'm with is called FURE. It stands for Families United for Racial and Economic Qualities. We work alongside with the Fifth Avenue Committee, and we're working to win passage of the Access to Training and Education Bill, which would allow people on welfare to choose education instead of workfare or other city programs. The bill was introduced to the City Council in 2001, and we're fighting to make sure it gets passed in 2002. We're working with other groups around the country to make sure that TANF reauthorization in 2002 works to end poverty, not reduce caseloads. We're also organizing to eliminate the 5-year time limit imposed on welfare benefits and to stop the abuses at welfare centers. A year ago, we won passage of the Transitional Employment Program, which would create 7,500 public jobs over 3 years to WEP workers. Giuliani illegally refused to make the program happen, so now we're working to get that program back to be implemented. Our staff recently met with Senator Clinton, her staff, and they liked the idea, so now we're going to see what Hillary thinks. We're also working with other organizations to meet with Mayor Michael Bloomberg. We put him on a 100-day probationary period. If he doesn't work with us by the 70th day of office with our list of issues, then on his 100th day in office, he'll have his first major protest. Also, we have 2 trips to Washington in February and in March to meet with members of Congress to have input on what we want to go in the next welfare bill. To find out more information about FURE, there's literature and calendars in the back of the room. It's all free on the table. And last night, President Bush said in his union address that he wants to reduce the dependency of welfare and offer every American a job. Well, we'll see about that. We shall see. So come on, everybody. You know the drill now. What do we want?
Justice.
Thank you. Thank you. He knows the drill. Come on. And when do we want it?
Yeah.
That's right. Peace out.
Okay, let me introduce. Sorry, it would be really nice if you could respect the chair. Why don't you just protest WEF on Saturday? Francis Fox Piven will be our next speaker.
There's a lot of globalization talk in New York this week, and some of that talk is about real things, real changes that have occurred in the world economy. Some of that talk is about accelerated trade. Some of that talk is about the movement of capital investment around the globe. Some of that talk is about the movement of people, of working people around the globe. And some of that talk is about the growing inequality across the globe that has accompanied the internationalization of markets. So some of globalization talk does direct us to think about our world. But a lot of this globalization argument is a big ideological ruse. It's an argument about the nature of markets. It's an argument that says that markets, which were once regional and then were national, are now international. How is that happening? Well, it's happening because markets expand. They're sort of natural organisms, and you can't stop them from growing and expanding. They expand outward and they expand downward, so they reach into communities and they reach into families. It's inevitable. It's a kind of natural law. No one is responsible. This is 19th century laissez-faire updated to include the whole thing. Well, that part of globalization talk is wrong. Markets are not natural. They don't expand naturally. They were, from the outset, a political construction. It was government and politics that created private property, government and politics that created currency, government and politics that created the contracts, without which there would not be any markets. And this isn't even to mention the role of government and politics in creating the unnatural market monopolies, the great fortunes in the United States of the railroads and the utilities. Well, what was true in the past is true today. It's true that international trade has accelerated and that capital whizzes around the globe. But that's not because of something natural that has grown and developed. That's because of politics. A politics which bends governments so that currency regulations, taxation, trade rules, investment protections, the great international new superstructures like the IMF and the WTO and the World Bank, who created those? Governments and domestic politics created those organizations, not to mention the military force which makes the internationalization of trade and investment so safe. Well, so in a way, it's true, there is internationalization, but what's fundamentally and profoundly wrong is the way in which we're led to understand how and why it's happening. The same thing is happening within the United States. As in across the globe, inequality is growing in the United States very, very sharply, very, very rapidly over the last 30 years. It's inequality of income, inequality of wealth. 1% of the American population now owns 40% of our wealth, which is the kind of pattern that we're accustomed to in Central America, Latin America. Now, the ramifications of this inequality on our lives is pervasive. It's a very serious development. You know, conservatives like to talk about the deterioration of the family, and they talk about it as though it's a moral problem. But it is true that families are stressed, and they're stressed because all the parents are working longer hours in order to keep up their income. We have seen in the last two decades an increase of 4 months of full-time work among two-parent families. That's a historic reversal in a pattern that we expected. Things would gradually get a little bit better. So no one is there to do the family work. Nobody makes the family meals. Nobody does the birthdays. Nobody takes the kids to the dentist because everybody is working, 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 working. That isn't a moral problem. That's an economic problem, and it's a reflection of the fact that people have to move so fast just to maintain their income. Or community life. Who does the volunteering that makes communities survive? Or what about our politics and the impact of eons, all of this money flooding, swamping our political processes? Well, why is this happening? For a long time, increasing inequality in the United States was denied. wasn't happening. You're measuring, you're taking the wrong beginning point, the wrong end point, you're using the wrong... But now they don't... it's so extreme that nobody denies it. Instead, they say what they're saying internationally. It's the result of globalization and the technological change which makes globalization possible. With a high-tech economy, global economy, naturally the more educated, more skilled people are more rewarded. Moreover, in a global economy, American workers have to compete with workers around the globe. They can't ask for too much. Indeed, they can't ask for what they used to get. Moreover, even the American government has to pay attention to the discipline of international markets. They can't tax business in ways that would lead somebody to click a mouse and reinvest in Sri Lanka. So therefore, they can't fund the programs that people need, and so forth and so on. So workers are pitted against each other across the globe. Governments are pitted against. But listen, this isn't true. It's not true. It's a trick. In Western Europe, for example, which is not idyllic, but in Western Europe, workers have 5 weeks vacation. Their workers are paid more than ours in Germany, for example. Their social programs haven't been cut the way ours have. Their unions haven't been buffeted the way ours have. And they're more exposed to the global economy than the United States. It's not globalization. It's a class mobilization that dates from the early 1970s when American profits were being squeezed by competition from Germany and Japan, squeezed also by the labor mobilizations of the 1960s and the community mobilizations of the 1960s, where people demanded more wages, better working conditions, and better social programs, and squeezed finally by rising oil prices. American business decided that they had to enter politics to do something about the pressure on their profits from these sources. This wasn't globalization. This is class conflict. And they entered politics by organizing new peak organizations, reviving the National Association of Manufacturers, reviving the Chambers of Commerce, reviving all of their trade organizations, turning CEOs into lobbyists, making K Street the disgusting pig pen it is. And what did they do? The first thing they did is the first thing they did when they had their first big political victory, when Reagan became president, total political victory. They win when both parties take the presidency, but this is a total political victory. The first thing they did is they pressed for slashed taxes. $750 billion were given back in the first four-year Reagan term, at the same time as the military buildup, began. The second thing they really wanted was complete deregulation. They began trying to get the environmental regulations, the workplace regulations eliminated under the Reagan administration. Some of you, not many of you, will remember that. Some of those people actually had to go to jail. They were so flamboyant in the way they did their things. And they're continuing. I mean, look at what this Bush administration has done to environmental regulations. Amazing. Amazing. And what they're doing to taxes. And then their assault on labor. The assault on labor took place in the workplace. It took place through whittling, hollowing out the National Labor Relations Board. It also took place by attacking the social programs which give labor some autonomy, some independence, so that workers feel that they can ask for more and go to and fight with their boss. So unemployment insurance has been gradually whittled away. Social Security has been rolled back. I can't explain. He won't let me explain how that has happened. The programs for the disabled have been slashed. And then we have also the great psychodrama that is the attack on poor women and children the great psychodrama of welfare reform, which not only takes away the pittance that we gave women who were raising children on their own, but makes women raising children, mainly minority women, into national pariahs, as the leading politicians of both parties assert that these women are guilty of sexual promiscuity, of sloth, that the problem of poverty that they confront is a moral problem. Thank you.
I want to introduce Sandra DeMarco, a teacher from the UFT who led the fight against privatization in Manhattan.
Hi, should I use my teacher voice or do I need a microphone? Microphone? Okay. I could do it either one. Good evening. How's my class doing today? So anyway, I have a couple of problems. I'm supposed to talk about the privatization of public schools, and I'm supposed to talk about Edison, and I have this cute little button. Unfortunately, everything that everybody's going to speak about at this table always affects me, because I'm a teacher. So we're going to talk about Argentina. That's where I was born, and there are teachers there. If we're going to talk about, you know, welfare, well, if I don't do my job, oh wait, that's not a job, it's a vocation, you might end up on welfare. If we're going to talk about the inequality of yada, 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 that also affects me. Everything just affects me. It's all about me, which is really all about you. Because how many of you went to a school? I don't care if it's private or public, because I actually went to private school. The difference is it was not for profit. That is the difference. So I'm not against private schools. I'm not against charter schools. There's so much I'm not against, because I'm not against education. I'm never against education. Hey, I'm a teacher. Why would I be? The only thing I'm against is anything that starts out in Texas. I don't know why. Somebody tell me why. Why would I be scared of anything that starts out in that state? And if you're from Texas, I'm not talking about you. It's not the state, it's not the people, it's whatever starts out in Texas. So what started out in Texas? Oh, let's see, everybody whose last name starts with Bush. Then what else started out in Texas? Oh, Edison started out in Texas. I wonder who funded them. Then what else started out in Texas? SFA, Success for All, CODE, Success for No One. All the programs in the Chancellor's District, successful, translation, success for none. But it is succeeding, in spite of it, because teachers will not let successful be success for none. That's just against our nature. So we change it, and we change it again, and we change it again, and we just change it again until it's success for everyone. Either we kick you, we beat you, we do whatever, but it will be successful. So now let's talk about Edison. Edison is now still happening. It's still alive and well, unfortunately. In Philadelphia, picked it up this morning. That's what I got in the morning. So now, Edison, thanks to me, and I mean me. I don't mean the Coalition for Better Education. I mean me. Because you know what I hate? I hate playing dirty. I hate playing unfair, and I hate having a battle of the wits with people who have no wits. So at my town hall meeting, one of the things I did is I gave them 5 minutes of my time privately and told them how to get my school. You want my school, then get it. But please, it's a bilingual school. Don't give me this. Don't give any of my parents this. It's in English. Most of them don't understand it. So don't do that. That's dumb. It's just dumb. So now they're learning. They're starting to give out bilingual pamphlets. I also told them, bring coffee and donuts, parents like that. Talk to them, but give them coffee and donuts. All parents like that. And I gave them a whole bunch of tips on how to get my school, and still they couldn't get it because they had me fighting with them. So I tried to even out the plane, and still they lost. I might actually go to Philadelphia this weekend. I don't know. So in Philadelphia, what they did is they passed this thing called Act 46. This is a great one. So I read it, and I highlighted it, And then I just took it to one soundbite because I know most students can only figure out one little thing and that's all they'll retain. This whole thing is taxation without representation. What all our forefathers have fought for, taxation without representation. So now Edison, like in New York, who paid for Edison? We did. Did Edison make money? Yes. How much? A lot. They made a lot. And they lost. Imagine if they had won. They're going to make even more in Philadelphia because now Act 46 is here. Act 46 is there might be a Mr. Marco in Philadelphia. How are we going to get to her? So then what they did is they passed Act 46. Act 46 says that you are going to fund us whether you like it or not. We're going to come to town whether you like it or not, grassroots movement or not. So they're going to win in Philadelphia. But luckily, there's a whole bunch of organizations. Let's see, the NAACP. And they're going to sue their little butts off. And there's a whole bunch of other people who are going to sue their butts off. You know why? Because they know how to read. Who taught them? Teachers. It all comes down to us. So that's Edison. And here, oh, this is my favorite. This is their report card. I didn't write this. They did. That's the beauty of it all. They buried themselves. I didn't have to do much work. This is a report card for Edison. Now, we all went to school, so who grades you? Who grades you? A teacher grades you. Who grades me? My principal, my AP, the chancellor, everybody above me. Now, who grades Edison? Edison, very good. I have very bright pupils here. Now, the problem with Edison is this. The numbers don't add up. They just don't. And I'm not good at math. I'm an art teacher. And they don't add up. They don't add up up and down, sideways, all around. I'll just give you one or two jokes. And I call them jokes because that's all you can really call them. Let's see. We have, here we go. We have a whole entire, we have three bilingual classes with no bilingual teachers. I wonder who's going to teach those kids. So they have bilingual classes, but they have no bilingual teachers to teach them. They offer bilingual education, or so they say, but the bilingual population in their school goes down every single year. Well, thank the Lord for that, because you got no teacher to teach them. So it's just like a big, sad, ugly joke. And we're paying for it. And that's really it. We're paying for it. And we're going to keep on paying for it, and we're going to keep on paying for it, and we're going to keep paying for anything that comes out of Texas. And that's it. Do I still have another minute? I mean, that's really it. That's it. We're going to pay for anything coming out of Texas. We now have taxation without representation. Thank you, Bush. I don't know what else to say. I mean, it's just so ridiculous. I can't even really talk about it. I get sick. It's they have ESL. But no ESL teachers. They believe in African American, yada yada, but no African American teachers. You should have seen the brigade that came to my school. They turned around and everybody was black. It was so offensive to the black teachers. They got so offended. Every black teacher there was so offended. But even more so was the majority of the teachers because they're Spanish. So you targeted the wrong population. You were in the wrong school. Because, by the way, I'm not in Crown Heights. I'm in Harlem. And I'm in mid-Harlem, where most of my population is either Dominican or Puerto Rican, with some black people, some black children. So they didn't know who on earth they were targeting. They didn't know me, but I knew them. So they lost. And that was it. Do I still have another minute? Okay, so, because I'm just about bullets. I just want you to get the point. Texas stinks. Anyway. That's it. The numbers don't add up. They never do. They won't add up in Philadelphia. They never added up in Texas. They don't add up anywhere. If Edison comes to town, it doesn't add up. If SFA is in town, it doesn't add up. Anything that has Bush somewhere in the background doesn't add up. It doesn't add up. His budget doesn't add up. Last night, I dared to listen to the State of the Union, but I bought a bottle of wine first, and I don't drink. And I drank most of it as I'm getting upset. And I have news for you. And this is going to, this is the news. In about 10 years, we're going to have another war. And I don't know what it is, But guess who's going to fund it? Yes! Now guess who's going to be the president? Jed! It's always Bush. I'm going for his second son, and I'm going for Bush if we don't stop it. It's always Bush. That's it. I'm done. Have a nice evening.
Let me just introduce Michael Letwin, who is representing New York City Labor Against the War.
Well, that's a hard act to follow, that Edison Act. So I'm sorry that I have to go next, but it's a pleasure to be here tonight, and thank you to the ISO for sponsoring this event. My name is Michael Letwin. I'm president of the Association of Legal Aid Attorneys, which is a local of the UAW, Local 2325. However, I am not speaking on behalf of the union. Our union does not have a position on the war. But I am speaking tonight on behalf of New York City Labor Against the War, which is a coalition that has developed since 9/11, and I want to talk for just a few minutes about some of the issues that have come up in regard to that. You know, picking up on what the sister said earlier, before, or even on the morning of 9/11, before the attacks took place, we were looking forward, I think probably everybody in this room anyway, to the end of Giuliani time, to an attempt to try to stop the attacks on labor in this city, stop the attacks on services, public services for poor people and for working people, put an end to workfare, and put an end to the kind of police abuse that had brought us the torture of Abner Louima, the murder of Amadou Diallo and Patrick Dorisman. And so it's not only a terrible tragedy, what happened itself on 9/11, which of course it is, and a terrible crime, but equally bad and arguably worse is the way in which that has been used as a pretext since 9/11 to really escalate those very policies that many of us had hoped to stop and to make them more than ever national and local policy, regardless of who's in office. And so now we see, for example, that with the new budget coming down locally, they're talking about a $5 billion city budget deficit. I know one of the topics tonight is city budget cuts. Well, we can be looking forward to a very severe attack on all the services that you've heard about tonight and that you otherwise might use, as well as the various kinds of things that have gone on during the previous 8 years. And so 9/11 has been a terrible tragedy in many ways, and I don't think I need to detail that for you, both for the people of who were killed on 9/11, who have suffered as a result of it, both in this country and, of course, the victims of it abroad from American terrorism in response, that is, American government terrorism. So what I wanted to say a few words about tonight is how labor has responded to these various events, both nationally and locally. And I guess the first thing to say is that as a whole, or predominantly, labor has responded by supporting the war of the Bush administration, or really it's the war of the Bush administration and the rest of the government, because they're all pretty much supporting it. And that ranges from, on the one hand, a union like the Machinists, which if you go to their website talks about the need to nuke Afghanistan, all the way to less virulent but nonetheless pro-war statements by the AFL-CIO generally. But nonetheless, there has been a minority response that's very different than that. And that's the response that we in New York City Labor Against the War have tried to reflect. And I think it's fair to say that we've taken our inspiration, both consciously and unconsciously, from a group during the war, the movement against the Vietnam War, and that was Vietnam Veterans Against the War. I don't know how many people here remember that group. Raise your hands if you do. But they are and were one of the most important anti-war forces during Vietnam. And the reason is because they had a credibility that many of us made the same arguments for or against the war at that time, but they were the ones who were there. Those veterans were working class guys who you could not argue with their experience. And they knew better than anyone, at least in this country, why that war was so wrong. And so when they came out against the war, they had a tremendous credibility with people in this country. And you may have seen those films of them throwing the medals back to the Congress that they had gotten in Vietnam because they learned what the truth of that war had been about in terms of the brutality and the destruction that it had wreaked for no legitimate purpose. And so we tried, I think, to mirror that in New York City Labor Against the War by making a statement that, small as our number might be, that is, in this group, in this response on the part of working people, that it was important that there were people identified as workers in New York City, members of trade unions, however small we might be in number, who were willing to come out and say that, yes, we were here on 9/11, yes, we were in or at or near the World Trade Center and saw it go down, and yes, that was a terrible crime, and we suffered from that. And it's for that very reason that we oppose inflicting that suffering on the people of Afghanistan or the Philippines or any other country around the world. And we tried to do that not in terms of pacifism, because frankly, that wasn't the position I think that most of us who came together in this group really came from. It was rather an attempt to make the argument that this war is not in the interest of American working people, and that there are a number of reasons why that's true. And those are outlined. I'm not going to bore you by reading it, but there's a statement here called New York City Labor Against the War, which is the main activity of our organization. It is to date signed by 800 or more than 800 trade unionists from both New York City and also from other cities and countries around the world. How many people here are trade union members? All right, well, I urge you, if you have not signed this, please take a copy of it tonight, give it back to us. We have a couple of brothers here from our organization. We're going to stand up now, have them there. We have a limited number of copies, but if you would please raise your hands as we talk, he will pass them out to you and collect them. But the bottom line is that our arguments were that whether it's the war abroad or the war at home, whether it's the attack, the bombing, the cluster bombing, the attacks on Afghanistan, whether it's the attack on immigrants in this country or civil liberties, whether it's the attack on working people, the huge war profiteering that has gone on since 9/11, that all of that is something that has to be opposed by American labor. And we're working with a number of small groups in other cities that share those concerns. Let me just finish by saying this. I think it's fairly obvious from the fact that you're here tonight that you know that although the war in Afghanistan may be nearly over, the war itself is not. And that isn't something that I or you need to say. That's something that Bush says every day and said last night on television. So we would like to ask the following things in addition to whatever else you might do. One, again, is please sign our statement and give it to other union members who you may know, whether they're in your family or friends. Secondly, tomorrow, and there's a number of events this week that have been alluded to, but I want to stress a couple of them that are particularly important. One, tomorrow at 2:30, there is a AFL-CIO sponsored forum about globalization. It's the one labor-sponsored event, and much as I wish it was an anti-war event, at least it's an event that labor, official labor, has put out there, and we urge people to come. That's going to be in Midtown tomorrow. Secondly, at 4:30 at 54th and 5th Avenue is a rally, and that's the most important thing. It's a rally primarily of garment workers against sweatshops in regard to globalization. Please come to that rally and join us there. Secondly, there is, as people mentioned earlier, the Counter Summit this week at Columbia, and that's important to come to. And the demonstration on the 2nd is very important on Saturday. Please do come to that. And finally, if you're interested in New York City labor against the war, our next meeting is on February 11th. And if you're interested in that, please come up and see us, and we'll be happy to tell you about it. Thank you very much.
I'm honored to introduce our last speaker. Greg Palast is an investigative reporter with BBC Television's Newsnight. He's a columnist with The Guardian in England, and he has a couple of books coming out soon. Pluto Press will be publishing The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, and he also has a quite timely new book on Enron and the power industry. But according to the IMF spokesperson, Greg is a master of misinformation. The WTO calls Greg's reporting rubbish, rubbish, rubbish. And according to the Boston Chronicle, no one has investigated the Bush family like Greg Palast and lived to tell about it. So, Greg, we all have your back. Let me introduce Greg and Narappa.
I'm going to come up here so you can see me. I can see you. And I want to show you a couple things. I'm sorry. I just got off the plane from London with... I know you expected me to sound like Henry Higgins, I'm actually an L.A. Ho-daddy who's in kind of journalistic exile. And maybe you'll figure out why by the end. I'm going to show you a couple things. Here's one document. And it says, well, maybe I'm not supposed to show it. It says, this, is anyone here from the World Bank? It says, it says, World Bank official use only. Its contents may not otherwise be disclosed without World Bank authorization. Can someone authorize? There you go. Thank you. This document has a restricted distribution and may be used by recipients only in the performance of their official duties. I'm an investigative reporter. My official duty is to show it to you. It is, it's a memorandum from a guy named Jim Wolfensohn, who's the president of the World Bank. Well, but you should hear what he has on his mind. And it is the country assistance strategy of the World Bank Group for the Argentine Republic. Now, this was written on this confidential report written June 25th, 2001. And the country had been following IMF and World Bank dicta for 8 years, and which turned the nation, which was the breadbasket and the cattle raiser for Latin America, to a point where there are a couple million people hunting for garbage every night in the streets. And when he wrote this, the nation was already on the edge of depression with 16% unemployment, and he wrote that the measures which they had implemented the year before that would greatly improve the outlook for the remainder of 2001 and for 2002, with growth expected to recover in the latter half of 2001. The goals set out in our last report remain valid and the strategy appropriate. But you should understand, it's not just blindness and arrogance. It combines with a certain element of cruelty. Because this document is a prescription. It says exactly what Argentina must do to maintain its credit with the World Bank and the IMF. And by the way, if you take loans from one, as they wonderfully call it, you have triggers which require you to take conditions of the other. So here's some of the things. Major advance was made to eliminate outdated labor contracts. In particular, they forced a 13% reduction in pensions in both public and private sector despite contracts. Now, then they were proud to announce, in the middle of a budding depression, that there was a $3 billion cut last year in primary expenditures, accommodating, and I'm quoting, accommodating the increase in interest obligations. Because as interest rates rose on the Argentine debt from 5% to 27% to 90%, what they did was that they cut expenditures. Now, where do you get $3 billion? Well, under a section called Poverty Reduction Strategy, they cut the payments for the emergency works programs for the salaries from $200 a month to $160 a month. So their poverty reduction strategy was to reduce the poor. I could go on, but we only have so much time. That's the beginning of their program. Think about it. After September 11th, and the economy was stalling, George Bush said that we had to spend $50 to $100 billion to prime the engine, the economic engine that was stalling in America. Argentina was in the grasp of a deadly depression, and they're saying, cut $3 billion, cut the budget dramatically and drastically. It's kind of like turning off the engines when a plane is in stall. And, you know, I'm trained as an economist, and when you cut your budget severely and run a surplus during a depression, the economic term is fucking stupid. Well, we're not fucking stupid, we're the IMF. So, you know, but anyway, you have to read it. You really, well, you're not supposed to read it, but don't tell anyone. There is also other elements in there. He was praising the privatization program, especially in the gas pipelines, and that raised something interesting, because David Corn, I spoke to Senator Tarogno, down in Argentina, who's a middle of the road politician, so David Corn of The Nation. And interestingly about that privatization program, in 1988, he was the public works minister and got a call when they were first beginning this privatization process. Got a call from a failed oil man in Texas named George W. Bush, who said that the incoming Bush administration, his dad had been elected president the week before, would really appreciate if Argentina would give a company called Enron the pipeline from Chile to Argentina. The minister was a bit offended because Enron was offering about one-tenth what everyone else was offering for the pipeline, but they did get it. It's interesting because, you know, Bush did say that he didn't get to know Ken Lay until 1994. That's an interesting term, get to know. Here's another document which you're not supposed to see. This is from inside the files of a power company. Oops, upside down. Well, you can't see it anyway. But it's accounts which were kept in the trunk of the car of a vice president of the company, which accounted for $117 million in spare parts that didn't exist. Now, the company was, a grand jury moved to indict the company. This was in 1989. But the Bush administration, using a codicil under the Justice Department's rules, was able to overturn the grand jury's vote, block the prosecution. They did so on the grounds that they had an auditor which had approved this strange second set of books called Arthur Anderson. That company, Southern Company, the vice president of the company, well, we just heard about Mr. Baxter topping himself off and taking himself out of the investigation of Enron. In that case, the vice president of the company, a real hero, was going to go and tell regulators and the state about the odd bookkeeping, Arthur Anderson's approved odd bookkeeping, and also bribes paid to politicians, which he himself had paid. Unfortunately, he announced that to the chairman of the board of the company and then asked for the company jet to go see the state attorney general, which 10 minutes after it took off on April 10th of 89, it blew up. And the company said, as they have said in Enron, it looked like he had no other way out, and we were sorry that he committed suicide. But that company, Southern Company, with a few others, next year in 1986, Enron was formed. They came up with a solution. One, to eliminate the rules which blocked this type of accounting. At the time, these guys were required to give back the money. They don't have to anymore. So they changed those rules, and they changed the rules that prohibited power companies in America from making political donations. So they did well. And so that's how we end up with Enron, removing the rules on the regulation of electricity, another wonder. I just read a report by the state of California describing how, in the past 2 years, what the experts call physical and economic withholding have added $20 billion to power costs in California. If you want to know how they did it, everyone's crying about Enron stockholders. I may be missing something here. They have been sucking California and the West Coast power consumers dry for years. This isn't about stockholders. None of those stockholders are complaining when they were bleeding the state of California dry and Argentina and India. But for example, you have to know how it's done. You have to know how it's done. Enron, for example, bid. Their traders bid to supply power to the state of California, 500 megawatts of power over a 15-megawatt line. I'm sorry if this is a little technical, but think about that, 500 megawatts of power through a 15-megawatt line. Now, if you do that, the line just burns up. Okay, so of course, they couldn't stuff the power through the line. Los Angeles was about to black out. As a result, the power buyers in California had to pay 10 and 20,000% above normal so the state wouldn't black out. And who are the, and then, who is going to sell them that? Enron. So now, the thing was that Enron was caught on that one. They were caught on that one by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. So Bush, right after he got into office, replaced the chairman of the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Right after that, Bill Clinton issued an executive order barring Enron from trading in California effectively. And the day after Bush took office, he was still hungover, and an order came out reversing the Clinton order. I don't know why. I'll just show you a couple of other things that maybe you're not supposed to see. This one says confidential secret. It goes with this. And this is from the office of the Secretary of State of Florida, Catherine Harris. And I'm kind of interested in this, and I got with it a computer disk, which I had decoded, and it was a list of 57,700 names of people to remove from the voter rolls who were removed in January and May of the election year. Now, it's an interesting list when I started, had it decoded by some computer experts for me, because the most interesting feature that jumps out at me, if you look here under something called voter race, black, black, white, black, black, white, black, 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 white, unknown black. These are the people who were removed from the voter rolls. Now, they were removed from the voter rolls on the grounds that they were supposedly felons who had been convicted of crimes. And I looked at their crimes all the way here. And this is just a random segment of the list I took. I didn't pick these out deliberately. I see Thomas Alvin Cooper, who was convicted of a crime in the year 2007. So we have... But we do know that he was quite guilty of being black. I had one county, one county went through these names, list, name by name, and about, of these people, about 5% are criminals. About 5%. About 95% have never committed a crime, but about 54% are quite guilty of being black. Now, George Bush won that election by the decision of Catherine Harris by 537 votes. 54% of the people removed, tens of thousands, innocent people, were black. You do the arithmetic. Now, the question is, do the numbers add up? It's like Edison. We could go on. In fact, if you want more of this junk, I'm going to sell you my goddamn book. It's Best Democracy Money Can Buy. You'll have copies of these things. And by the way, you read this all in the Times. I didn't have to tell you any of this, right? I will say, on this voter purge, some of this I was able to print in the Washington Post. Now, I came out with a story 2 weeks after the election when Gore had yet to concede. The Post printed it 7 months later. After the Civil Rights Commission said that the information was correct. Now, what do we do? You know, I could go on with this. I mean, what's the solution? I asked a friend of mine, Joe Stiglitz. He was at the World Bank. He was the chief economist of the World Bank, and he raised some questions. He said, you know, he was telling me, he actually went to Wolfensohn and these other characters. He said, you know, every country we go to seems to go completely to hell in a basket. They said, well, there's a lot of success stories. There's China. And he said, yeah, well, China told us to go to hell. There's Botswana. They told us to go to hell. He said, but we do have big success. You can't argue with Argentina. And I said, well, what's the problem? And he said, you know, the problem was that they're like medieval doctors. They're like medieval doctors, where they added the leeches, and if the patient died, they said, well, he still had some blood left in him. You know, so they believe in what they're doing. But that also gives me an idea of what the solution is. Remove the bloodsuckers. Thanks.